Hello, 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 and welcome to the first episode of Radio Nerd here on Radio Laureate. My name is Kiefer, and I'm going to be the host for this show. I guess we'd start off with a little bit of a introduction talking about what the show is going to be about. Essentially, what I want to do is look at nerd and geek culture, all varieties of that, and look at it in a progressive way, sort of examine it down, key out some of the like strong issues that come from a source of media that has predominantly been the theater of one specific type of people, that being straight white men. And I want to examine where changes can be made, examine where we can do some more thoughtful work at making this more inclusive area of media, and especially considering the dominance of huge properties like Marvel movies or even anime now in Western culture here, and specifically here in Canada. It's important for us to acknowledge that there are diverse people watching these forms of media, or consuming, I should say, these forms of media. And it's important for us to talk about what it means for those forms of media to be palatable to these different people who are diverse. Let's talk a little bit about me. Why not? It's a great topic. I love talking about it. As I said, my name's Kiefer. I'm bisexual man. I am white, and I am cisgendered man. Basically, I've always consumed nerd culture since I was really young. Honestly, like everything. TV shows, comic books, anime, manga, you know, different types of cartoons, board games, video games, everything, really. And so I thought it would be a great idea to take that passion and that love for an area of things and apply it to something else that I'm passionate about, and that being my own personal identity as bisexual, and taking that and showing how people who are in more diverse, non-straight areas, and as well extending to other people, non-white areas and non-male areas, because that is the dominant form of consumer and of creator of a lot of these things that we're consuming on huge, unprecedented scales. Especially, I'm going to keep saying the Marvel movies because they are the best example of nerd culture sort of taking over popular culture. And it's important that as that begins to happen more, we continue to talk about these things, continue to discuss what is important to audiences that are seeing it, because it's important for people to be able to see themselves within the media that they are consuming. I know, at least for me, it's really important. And that comes down to the topic in the name for this episode. Bit of a play on words. Please don't groan too hard. It's called A Tale of Two Bis. And we're going to be talking about representation. Specifically, we're going to be focusing on LGBTQ plus representation. Because that's my particular, as a member of that group, that's a particular area of expertise, I guess. I don't know if that's the right word to use, but whatever. Yeah, so it's important to, I think, this to come from me specifically because I am a member of that group. Representation, I will put a caveat here that representation is something that is important for everyone who is from a more diverse group, that isn't part of, you know, straight white men, basically. But what I think would be important is to have someone who represents those groups talking about that specifically. So it's very possible that I might, in a future episode, come back and readdress representation, possibly with guests. I think that would be a good idea. And I'm saying this for the benefit of people who are listening and also for the benefit of myself, so I don't forget that I said this. So what we're going to do is we're going to start off by talking about two specific representations of bisexual characters. A good one and a bad one. We're going to start with the bad because I'm a pessimist, and that's where we're going to do it. And we're going to talk about some of the problems that come with this type of representation. And then we're going to talk about how to do it, how it's been done well. And then we're going to go into some more, well, we'll get to that. We'll just start with this. So firstly, we're going to start with a, example from Japan. I am a big consumer of, anime and, manga and light novels and all the various things that come from Japan. Bit of a weeb, not that that's a bad thing. But there are obviously different issues that we get to see with Japan. As far as I'm aware, Japan is a country that doesn't allow same-sex marriage. I'm not 100% sure that's correct. Let me check. Well, we're just sitting here. Yeah, Japan's the only country in the G7, actually, that does not legally recognize same-sex unions in any form. So that's important to talk about, I think, a little bit. I will address cultural differences after the end of this example. To me, when a piece of media is so large that it's reaching globally, I think cultural differences become less of a shield that people can hide behind for terrible representation or terrible characters. That's my personal opinion. And people can feel free to dispute that. That's perfectly fine. I mean, this is supposed to be a conversation, right? The only way that we really get better and talk more about issues like that is by having a conversation. But let's get into it. My Hero Academia. I'm sure a bunch of people know where I'm going with this because this is fairly recent news. I'm going to be pulling most of my information from this because I haven't read the actual manga chapter that this is on. I never really read the manga of My Hero Academia. I watched the anime to a certain degree. But I'll most of this information is going to be pulled from a Polygon article on August 3rd of this year by Anna Diaz. So My Hero Academia is a manga, anime, big franchise here, for sure, written by Kohei Horikoshi. It's an action sort of series, and it, basically takes place, at a school that is training superheroes, is the biggest, rundown of it. It appealed to me because, I'm not normally into this specific type of anime, the high action sort of shonen or aimed towards sort of like a younger male audience type of anime. It's not usually my thing. I'm more of a Gundam kind of person in that regard. But this got me because I like comic books and I like superheroes. So the story sort of follows the main character, Deku, who is... a boy who's born without a quirk, which is the superpower, or superpowers in this specific universe. And he ends up gaining a quirk and still wants to become like a hero. And it's all about his sort of journey and the characters around him. Now, specifically another character that I'm going to go over, and you'll see why I'm going to talk about this other character, is Minoru Mineta. I said that quick, but anyways, he's sort of the comic relief character to a certain degree, but it's this bad trope in anime and manga, and specifically Japanese media, of having, like, a hyper pervert, essentially, as the as like the comic relief, right? He's the type of character who tries to like peek at women in the bath, or tries to cop a feel when he's fighting people, stuff like that. Stuff that's like not okay and is really distasteful, I would say. But it's sort of a relic of earlier times in anime, something I would hope more writers would do away with, but here we are, already with it. And in a recent episode, or in a recent chapter of the manga, specifically chapter 321, there's a huge battle, and I believe Deku is in some ways demoralized or something like that. The exact context doesn't necessarily matter, but Mineta, during the fight, remembers Deku, and he says that he fell for him. Now, a note should be made here that translation from Japanese isn't always a one-to-one thing, and it could have been intended to not be a bisexual coming out, but it was very much so appearing to be that. Like, he is essentially confessing his love to Deku, which is the first canonically LGBTQ plus character in the series. The pervert character is bisexual. So I'm going to let that one sink in and say it again, because the pervert character is bisexual. Why is this a problem? Well, one of the traditionally slung hateful remarks at bisexual people is specifically that they are overly sexual, and that they are they can't choose between either gender, sort of thing, between male or female, you know, that they want to just be able to have their run of the mill, right? It's a very negative stereotype, a very hurtful stereotype, and one that I know that I've dealt with in many regards, and that is honestly really antiquated. I mean, in a current culture that like sexualizes everything, basically, it's kind of really hypocritical to address someone who, you know, has more capacity within them, or I shouldn't say that, not capacity, maybe capacity. I don't know. It's not correct, first of all, and it's really detrimental to bisexual people. There was a humongous Twitter storm, which is a word I don't really like to use, but, you know, here we are, about this. There was memes plenty, lots of people complaining about it and really upset about it, especially in, I know that maybe the casual listener who's not really into Japanese stuff won't know this, but there is a very active shipping community within the My Hero Academia fandom, and there are main characters who have definitely shown some very close to gay or even bisexual leanings, specifically with, I'm forgetting the name. But there's Bakugo and I forget the name of the other character, but his power is to, like, harden his body super hard. Anyways, they're a huge ship. There's lots of other ships, too. There's ships between the main character and other male main characters. I think it's important to note that in a lot of these shonen-type anime, they sometimes relegate female characters a lot as well to more back roles. I think My Hero Academia has been fairly decent about that. I'm also a man, though, so I'm not going to speak to specifically those things. I don't think I'm a good authority on how female representation is going to be done well. So I'll leave that up to possibly a follow-up episode, like I said before. So anyways, there's a lot of backlash because of this. Especially just like, I don't think I need to really explain how, why this is such a struggle for me to explain why it's terrible. It's pretty plain, you know, to take the character that is essentially, you know, a sexual assaulter. Is that the right word? Sexual assaulter? It doesn't matter. Anyways, who sexually assaults people, essentially, and sexually harasses people on the regular, and then to have that be your first official LGBTQ character, it associates a lot with historical uses of people who have been gay, bi, lesbian, or trans as sexual deviants. And associating those things together is horrible. That's how, 100%, you guys can look this up. I didn't grab a quotation for this or whatever, but that's how people were split up in concentration camps during the Holocaust. The Nazis split up people who were gay and gave them specific, their pink triangles as their mark. And split them up away from the rest of the people who were in the concentration camp and put them with other sexual deviants, people like pedophiles and stuff like that. So there's a long, real history of associating people who are not straight with people who have sexual disorders or sexual problems. And this is a terrible association to make at any time, really. Especially now when we are seeing so much more representation. Like I said before, I was going to discuss Japan to a certain degree. Japan doesn't have same-sex marriage. Japan's a very culturally conservative and traditional place, unfortunately, with all this. Their media is being consumed globally. And like I said before, in my mind, a lot of the problem, I think, that comes here is writers thinking about just a Japanese audience and not understanding that their product is being consumed overseas, is being consumed globally, right? My Hero Academia has, like, global fandoms. Right before the pandemic hit, I know that seeing pictures and videos of conventions, the amount of people dressed up as My Hero Academia characters was the most. And that's sort of your gauge for how popular something is. I remember when Sword Art Online came out a number of years ago, everybody was dressed up as the main character or dressed up as some of the main female leads. Your gauge for how popular an anime is like how many people are cosplaying it to a certain degree. It's an informal gauge. I'm not going to say it's an official gauge or anything like that. This is sort of the gauge I use. It's incredibly popular here in the West. And when there is that many people who are buying your property, who are watching it on Crunchyroll or, you know, your other similar cast of choice, it's important to think about your global audience. It's important to think about the fact that your audience isn't all Japanese. Your audience isn't all the same people. And that's not to say that there aren't people in Japan who are LGBTQ plus. I'm sure there's plenty of people that are not comfortable being out in Japan. Understandably so, especially thinking about places in the United States, even places here in Canada that are ultra-conservative or that are, you know, very Christian values, that it's hard, you know? I grew up in areas like that. I grew up in a high school where, you know, gay was thrown around as a slur, essentially, or as a term for things that are dumb or whatever. And it's hard when you know that you in some ways fit into that category when people use it as a detrimental word, it's hard for you to come out and talk about it and talk about that you are a member of that group. But let's look at a little more positive of a representation here. We're going to talk about Tim Drake, who is the third Robin, Batman's sidekick, for just to clarify. And we're going to talk about Urban Legends number 6, which is a recent issue that came out. Actually, within a couple of weeks of the chapter from My Hero Academia, and also concerning superheroes. So these the parallels here are really fascinating. The world sometimes just does work like that. So Tim Drake has been Robin for quite a while. He has had for a while previous to this been in a relationship with a woman. But they had broken up recently, and talking in more recent news here, we have the Urban Legends number 6. So what happens essentially is Tim, he's been tracking a Batman villain named Chaos Monster. I'm not familiar with the villain. I don't know what the villain does, but it doesn't really matter. And he gets there just in time before he's going to sacrifice a friend of Tim's named Bernard. So Tim saves Bernard, fights off Chaos Monster and their henchmen. Yeah, I don't see a... Oh, his henchmen. Never mind. Anyways, Bernard and him have a conversation, and they're friends, but they're friends who are both exploring what their sexuality is, and end up... finishing off the episode, planning on going on a date. And it's a really well done representation of bisexuality. It's a struggle for a lot of people who are bisexual to really understand what their sexuality is. It was for me. And it is for a lot of other people. And it's something that I think is really important to depict that struggle within media. The woman he was in a relationship with previously is Stephanie Brown, who is a superhero spoiler, another member of sort of the Bat family of villains, superheroes. Tim's been sort of talked about for a long time. There were previous incarnations of Tim that many people thought were gay. And this outcoming as bisexual, which, by the way, I should mention here, the story was written by Megan Fitzmartin, the art by Belen Ortega, and the colors and letters, or the colors were by Alejandro Sanchez, and the letters by Pat Brosman, or Brosso. Sorry if I pronounced any of those incorrectly. but it was really well done. And it was really, it felt real. It felt like a good, like, it felt like Tim was bisexual, if that makes sense. That feeling of actually seeing someone who you can feel like has had those same experiences as you, I think, is the core to good representation. That person doesn't have to look like everybody thinks a gay or bisexual or lesbian or trans person should look like. And I should say that's not discounting anybody else under the LGBTQ heading. I'm just rattling off as I talk. But it's important to show that he had a relationship with a woman beforehand, and he's now going on a relationship into a budding relationship with a man. And that's sometimes how it works for bisexual people, you know? Sometimes, you know, you fall in love with a guy or you fall in love with a girl. Like, it doesn't matter. It just happens. And that's not to say that bisexual people won't fall in love with non-binary people as well. That's obviously also a possibility. But to get back to it, it's just really important to look at how this is done as a good blueprint, I think would be the word to use here. A good blueprint to show how you can represent someone within, who's specifically a bisexual, within media. I have less to talk about here with regards to the good representation, because obviously it kind of speaks for itself that it is good representation. It's really, you know, DC has been pretty fantastic lately about it. Something else that comes to mind Poison Ivy and Harley Quinn. There we go. Poison Ivy and Harley Quinn, who have been Harley Quinn has a cartoon, and also in the comic books, I think. For a long time, there was sort of that coding, I should say. We'll get into that. I'm going to talk about queer coding later on in a little bit here. But there was that coding, even in the 90s Batman animated series cartoon, where there were some episodes where they talked about that Poison Ivy and Harley Quinn lived together. And there was just that feeling always in the background that Harley Quinn was kind of exploring her sexuality. Whether she's lesbian or bisexual doesn't really matter at the end of the day. But it's kind of come more open that they are dating, or at least, you know, have a relationship that is of that kind. And I think it's good. Harley Quinn was a character who was basically relegated to being, you know, a punching bag and an example of terrible relationships with abusive men. And I think evolving that character and making them into, you know, a strong leading character that can also represent, you know, not just women, but also lesbian or queer women in general, is really good. And it's a really great step in the right direction for DC. I tend to read a little more DC. I know a fair amount, like more modern DC stuff. I don't read as much Marvel, but from what I've been hearing, Marvel's not doing bad either. And I think that that's really important, that we start at ground zero almost, like with comic books. Comic books being that, you know, traditional nerd playground that was predominantly, you know, the nerdy white straight man who was writing it, you know? I think it's important to start there and to work our way up to everything else with regards to good representation. So let's have a little bit of a small discussion here about two terms that I just want to sort of define for you, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about queer coding as well. Just to get into some of these things and sort of talk about why I'm just talking about LGBTQ plus representation right now. So specifically, I want to talk about tokenism, which Oxford Dictionary defines as, this actually is from Oxford Dictionary. Both of these definitions are going to be just because it's easy to find them from one source. But essentially, tokenism is the practice of making only a perfunctory or symbolic effort to do a particular thing, especially by recruiting a small number of people from underrepresented groups in order to give the appearance of sexual or racial equality within a workforce. So that's specifically with regards to a workforce, but that also works when you're talking about a cast of characters, right? Using only gay people as supporting characters, or using only having only one black character or one character who is a person of color is tokenism, essentially. It's being like, hey, look, we're being representative by having a cast of all white people and then having one black person. Or, hey, we're being representative by showing this high school group of kids and one of the kids is gay. Nobody else is LGBTQ at all. No, nobody's bisexual, nobody's lesbian, just one gay kid. that's tokenism, right? And that's obviously bad representation. What tokenism leads to is assuming that these groups are very small when they're not. It also means, it's also relegating someone's full identity to character tropes. Because when you have only one character who's a member of a specific racial or sexual minority, what you have is that character becomes that minority. You lose a character essentially because you just have like a bundle of tropes and misconceptions and at the worst stereotypes. And that's not what anybody wants. Nobody wants to be completely reduced to be a stereotype. That's not a great feeling. And it's not something that people want to see in media when they're watching something or playing something for that matter. I haven't really talked about video games much, but LGBTQ plus representation in video games is not great, to say the least. Especially in AAA titles and big titles from big companies. So what we end up getting is a lack of that in video games for sure. And I'll probably come back to this in a different episode and talk more about how the problems in video games. Specifically here, we're going to talk about wide media. You know, not that anime and comic books are particularly wide, but these are things that are a little bit more accessible to everybody as opposed to video games. But anyways, I digress. Back to the second thing. The second definition here. I'm going to define intersectionality for you and talk about why I'm defining intersexuality. So intersectionality is the interconnected nature of social categorizations such as race, class, and gender as they apply to a given individual or group, regarded as creating overlapping and independent systems of discrimination or disadvantage. The term itself was coined by Kimberly Williams Crenshaw in a paper that she wrote in 1989. Specifically, it had to deal originally with feminism and intersexual feminism and the idea that women of color, black, indigenous people of color, deal with the issues surrounding gender inequality differently than white women. And intersectionality has now been applied to a lot of other aspects of diversity and examining diversity within an intellectual context. And it's really important for us to understand intersectionality. Yes. Freudian slip. Anyways, intersectionality is important, and it's the reason why I'm talking about LGBTQ plus representation. Because I can't fully understand what it is like to be a person of color who is trying to look for representation within media, or a woman looking for representation in media, because I am cisgendered and a man. For that matter, talking to a certain degree about, I haven't talked as much about transsexual or non-binary people. That's not to say that they're not struggling with the same problems with representation that I've been talking about, but just to say that I don't feel comfortable talking about somebody else's experience like it's my own, if that makes sense. I hope that's understandable. And like I said, this is almost an open invitation. If anybody does listen to this episode and they say, hey, you know, I am a member of this community, and I would really like to have a conversation about representation of my community within media and within nerd culture specifically, definitely reach out. Not by the end of this episode, but next episode, I should be making, I think I'm going to make an email address and an Instagram for this for the show. I don't know how like active I'll be on the Instagram, but I'm gonna make efforts to try to be out there and stuff like that, and definitely engage if you feel like you want to engage. Yeah, I think it's really important for this to be a conversation, like I've said before. So if you do want to come on and talk, we can definitely talk and see if it would be a good fit, and then invite you on. It'd be great. Anyways, intersectionality. It's important to think about when we're talking about these things and when we're having these conversations, because people do have different experiences based on how they grew up, based on, you know, their sexual or racial identity, their gender identity. Everything changes the experience that individual people have. Finally, we're going to talk a little bit here about queer coding. And then after this little conversation here, I'm going to talk about some other examples of good and bad representation. We're going to start with good this time and go on to bad. Just because using two, I think, is a little bit, even though they link together so well, and pat myself on the back for that one, I think it's important to put in a couple other things. We're going to talk a little bit about queer coding. And for this, I'm going to be taking some information from a Sci-Fi Wire article called The Strange, Difficult History of Queer Coding from 2018, June 8th, by Tricia Ennis. So we're going to talk about how what is queer coding is basically what I'm going to explain. And I'm not going to go super deep into it because queer coding is a very deep issue that we could go into and could be like an entire episode in and of itself. But I'm going to go into it a little bit just because I think it's important to talk about when we're talking about this stuff. But queer coding is essentially the process by which characters in a piece of media appear to be, or using the word code, queer. So this is when people look back, at, you know, the old childhood villains in a Disney movie or in a cartoon and think, oh, that character is, obviously queer. The thing that I always think about is, him from Powerpuff Girls. I don't know if that's a weird outdated reference, but, him was always obviously a transsexual person. Because they had a very deep voice, but dressed up in feminine clothing and appeared to be very feminine. And it's sort of one of the first, indications of it. I will discuss here, queer coding is not a positive or negative thing. It was used for a really long time in negative ways to portray negative stereotypes of people who were LGBTQ+. And the problem that comes from using queer coding in that way is it essentially becomes like a guidebook to how to poke fun at people who are queer. And obviously, I don't need to explain why that's bad. But it's also used in many ways in earlier or in more recent times in situations where the writers can't actively portray a queer character. They will use queer coding to signal that this character is supposed to be queer but cannot outright say it. That, to me, is another problematic area, because if we're in situations where we can't outright say that this character is queer, when it's very obvious that they are, that means there's some sort of censorship to a certain degree, or at least, you know, someone is inputting their bias to a certain degree within this piece of media. And that screams other issues in my ears, other than just representation. But it's something that to keep in mind with regards to queer coding. Yeah, I mean, like I said, queer coding is a very deep and complex issue, and something that I think almost deserves an entire well researched paper, or a paper I should episode in a paper too, honestly, in and of itself. And I didn't do as much research on queer coding here. It was sort of a secondary thought at the end here. So I'm just like mentioning that queer coding is a thing. It's something that we should be aware of. And it's something that I think if you are personally interested in queer coding and how it relates to characters that may have had influences on you, whether that's you growing up or you now, definitely read into it. Look into queer coding. Do some of your own research. Have a conversation about it with someone. You know, talk about the problems that arise from not being able to straight up say, hey, I'm bisexual, or hey, I'm queer. You know, not being able to say those things out loud is hard, at the very least. All right, let's sort of bookend this episode by giving some more examples of representation and what they're good. Now, some of these might be topics of debate, because some people don't 100% agree that certain representations are good and certain representations are bad. And I think that's a really good thing. I think that having those conversations is the best idea. Being able to have these conversations about what we think is good and bad can only make creators better at showing complex characters. Because at the end of the day, not everybody is going to be the perfect gay themselves, you know? Like, everybody is different to a certain degree, and representation matters with regards to showing us that you can be any type of person, and that just being a certain sexual or gender identity, even racial identity, isn't your whole identity, right? This goes back to why I said tokenization, right? It's not someone who is bisexual, me being bisexual, that's not my entire identity. Obviously, this podcast is about issues in nerd culture. That's another key part of my identity. And talking about how we can depict characters that have their sexual, gender, or racial minority as part of their identity, but not their entire identity, is really the end goal. So let's talk about great or good examples, I should say. Avatar, Legend of Korra. At the end, the final season, I know a lot of people didn't really like Legend of Korra. I really enjoyed it. Maybe a controversial opinion. Anyways, at the final season, Korra ends up throughout the episode, or throughout the season, her and another female character, Asami, have been writing to each other. And they only see each other a few times throughout the season, but they've been writing continuously and keeping up. And at first, it sort of seems like they're just friends talking. But then it seems to get a lot more emotional, a lot deeper. And for a while, I sort of saw the writing on the wall myself, and I'm sure plenty of other queer people did too. But they end up together at the end. And Korra and Asami were both with men during parts of the series. And so it's a little up in the air whether or not they're lesbian or bisexual. But I mean, at the end of the day, they're queer. Doesn't really matter. And I think it was a really interesting way that the writers were able to show a relationship developing between two people of the same sex that wasn't hypersexualized and that was actually emotional and that felt like a real relationship. To me, a lot of people were pissed off at the end. I'm sure plenty of them were were white men who are straight. I should add that because I'm a white man too. And I wasn't pissed off. I was pretty happy. It was really nice. Anyways, it was good. I enjoyed it, and I thought it was well done. You can disagree. That's perfectly fine, obviously. I've said so many times already that this is a conversation. I'm going to keep saying that over the course of other episodes. But yeah, it's really important for us to have a conversation here. Next, we're going to talk about BoJack Horseman. I haven't actually watched BoJack Horseman, but when I was looking for good examples here, I came across BoJack. And apparently, in the third season, one of the characters comes out as asexual. I haven't really talked about asexual representation because I'm not asexual. But I think it's important to talk about asexual representation because you need to see that not everybody is hypersexual in shows like this. Not everybody is looking for a relationship. Not everybody is wanting sexual intimacy. And it's important for people who are ace to have that representation. And I've been told that BoJack does it really well. And of the things that I have seen of BoJack Horseman, it is a really good show that portrays a lot of different issues really well. I haven't seen season three and I haven't seen this stuff. I've seen, I think, parts of season one is what I've seen. But I enjoyed it. And it's gotten a lot of critical acclaim. And whatever you think of critics, they still, you know, do this as a job. They're informed to a certain degree about what should be good and shouldn't be good. Finally, something that another thing that I have seen, actually not finally, I have another example after this. I don't know why I said finally. Anyways, in Young Justice Season 3, this is another DC property. As you can tell, I'm a little bit of a DC fan. I watch all the Marvel movies too, and we'll talk about that. Honestly, I need to go out and see Shang-Chi, and I think I really should do a bit of an episode on that one too at some time. Anyways, Young Justice Season 3, Aqualad, who is now Aquaman, in the continuity of this particular series, is shown in the one episode very casually to have a boyfriend. The relationship is only really showcased in a couple of episodes, but the depth that they do it to and the very clear, you know, like loving relationship between the two of them and the normality that they do it with, you know, that, you know, he has a boyfriend, he's gay, this is what it is, you know, has very little effect on the character that has been growing throughout like two previous seasons of character development. And I think it's important here that this is again another token breaking thing, you know. Aqualad is also a person of color in this series as well. And having, I think it's important that we talk about some aspects of how people who are queer and who are also a person of color, in some ways, they're deracialized or become racially neutral, I believe is the term. And that's problematic in many degrees. I don't know if I can speak to how well Aqualad is done as a person of color, not being a person of color myself. But I think his representation as a queer character is really well done. Finally, I think it would be remiss if I didn't mention She-Ra on Netflix, which is, of course, very queer and very well done from what I've heard. I'm going to disappoint people by saying that I haven't actually seen it yet. I personally think that She-Ra is such an in-depth thing, and it's like five seasons long or something, five or six, I don't know. I watched He-Man a lot when I was younger. It was very formative. Skeletor was always my favorite, though. I think it's important that I sit down and watch it and maybe do an entire episode on She-Ra. So future Kiefer and fans who would like to hear me talk about She-Ra, or I shouldn't say fans, I probably don't have any fans, listeners, anybody, if you want me to talk about She-Ra for an entire episode, I will watch it and take notes and talk about She-Ra. Now, we're going to talk about the bad examples, and then I'm going to sort of end off this episode. For this, I think it's important to talk about tropes within the bad examples, because if I just started listing off bad examples, we would be here all night, all day. This is day when I'm recording it. I don't know why I said all night. But anyways, we're going to talk about a couple of tropes, and then we're going to just sort of wrap up. And now these aren't all of the tropes, but these are sort of some tropes that I picked out of a hat, essentially. One of them that comes up a lot is the gay best friend. Doesn't really need any explanation, but it's problematic because it relegates, again, it's, as I described, the tokenization, you know, it relegates gay and queer people to a supporting role, to a role where, you know, they're helping someone else, predominantly like a straight white woman, get love or whatever the theme of this particular piece of media is. It's problematic because it doesn't offer the room for that for that particular character to actually have any starlight or any actual representation. It relegates gay men to be the to be an accessory, essentially, which I don't need to like talk about why that's problematic. Another one is the murderous bisexual, and this is sort of ties into that idea of bisexual people being hypersexual, and using their sex as some sort of weapon. You see this in like Killer Instinct. Is that what that one is? It, more often than not, it's a female role that is using this sort of trope, but you see them in male roles too. It's problematic because it makes it leans into that sexual deviancy territory, and it also, to a certain degree, leans into the territory that they're using their sexuality as a weapon, which I don't have the words for why that's a problem, but I know that it doesn't sit well with me, to say the least. Going through a couple more here, bury your queer women is a trope, and that refers to the frequency at which queer people, and specifically queer women, are murdered or killed off very quickly within media of different types. I can't think of any specific examples that come straight to mind, but if you're a queer person, you know this, and if you're not, look around for it. Look it up a little bit. It's there. It's a really big problem. Immediately killing off anybody who is not straight, whether that's consciously or not consciously, almost worse if it's not consciously, because then your preconceptions are pretty baked deep there, I have to say. There's the bi-erasing bisexual trope. Now, this one I saw very evidently on, what was the show? House of Cards. Kevin Spacey's character. I know Kevin Spacey's canceled and we don't really need to dive into that, but essentially this is a person who, you know, it's again another example of how portraying bisexual characters is just like sexually ravenous and, you know, constantly wanting to, you know, consume, you know. It's portraying them as greedy, essentially, or lustful. Lustful. There we go. That's the word I was looking for. You know, greedy or lustful. And that's not how every bisexual person is. I'm sure there are plenty of bisexual people who are who are more sexual, you know? There's nothing wrong with that. But making it a trope is a very negative connotation, I think. Especially used by, you know, conservative, like a very right wing conservative groups who, you know, are trying to in many ways devalidate bisexual people. Finally, we're going to talk about everyone is straight. Everyone is straight's a trope. It's a conscious or unconscious trope, and again, like I said before, if it's unconscious, there are more problems there. But I think the best way to show this is by asking you if there are any queer characters in Big Bang Theory. And I pause there because there aren't. And I think this is the problem. It's good to bookend with this trope because this is the biggest problem with representation. Assuming that your entire demographic that is going to be watching this, because you're talking about nerd culture consistently, is all straight people, is incredibly, incredibly wrong. The diversity of people who have come to enjoy nerdy things is as diverse as our world is today. And it's important that if you want to keep those fans from a capitalistic mindset here, you want to show those fans that they are valued and that their influence on these pieces of media is shown. It's important to talk about these things. It's important to show these things because, you know, everybody deserves a bit of escapism from the crap that's going on in our world. I mean, especially after the past year and a half. And escapism is only good if you can actually see yourself there. And unfortunately for a lot of people who are queer, a lot of people who are black, indigenous, or a person of color, a lot of people who are women, it's hard for them to see themselves anywhere. And it's a problem, and that needs to be changed. It's a problem that, you know, is something that's important to me, and I think it's important to a lot of people, especially within nerd culture, because, as I've said, it's becoming more dominant and more a part of popular culture. Well, I think that was a good discussion. I had a good time. I hope you all enjoyed it, everybody watching or listening, not watching. What the heck? So this is the first episode. It's a little unpolished. I'm kind of getting into it. If you have any pointers or stuff, like I said, I'm going to try to set up an email and an Instagram for the next episode, and I will talk about them at the beginning of the next episode and probably at the end too. But for now, thank you for listening. It's been Kiefer, and I hope to see you next episode. Bye.